Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your drone bleed of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Across the wide Missouri, never enough, no, never enough.
You've just been assaulted. You've been assaulted. That is, tell us the name of the track, Ben Ratliff.
Brando.
Yeah, it is. That's right. It's Brando from Soust. Soust, as I'm sure all of our listeners are extremely aware of, is the new album by obscurantist singer-songwriter Scott Walker in collaboration with Droney Dude's son.
Right.
Get your right on magazine.
It was pretty much as soon as it was announced.
Absolutely.
People were like,
yeah.
Well, Scott Walker appeals to a certain kind of
shut-ins?
A certain kind of listener who does like to impress their friends and associates with the difficultness of what they like.
Is it true that these listeners only have two friends to impress, though?
No.
Let's just be honest.
No. No. Anyway, it's an acquired taste, mm-hmm. the Scott Walker thing. Sun can be the same way, but actually it's quite different. We can talk about that mm-hmm. later. As a critic, one of the things I'm really interested in is the whole question of how much one should be expected, maybe, to prepare in order to like something.
Mm-hmm.
How much one should know, how much one should be invested in something, you know, whether one should go more than halfway to an artist before they can, let's say, you know, truly understand them or something
and,
like that.
And
it's a fallacy. You know, there's this idea that you have to know what the artist intended in order to truly understand and appreciate. And I always felt that way about Scott Walker a little bit.
That you needed to understand.
Yeah. And I have to say that I have resisted Scott Walker a lot, with some exceptions, but really until this record, which I felt like, yes,
so is that why in your piece you say something to the effect of this is the first piece of Scott Walker music in the last, whatever, two decades, three decades that basically doesn't demand a full accounting of both its creation and also his backstory.
And an investment in the myth of Scott and the struggle of Scott and Scott as the great transformational artist, all of which is really interesting.
So let's go there.
Yes, I mean, that is what I do believe, and a lot of people disagree.
We will get soused. We will be there. But let's dial back 60 years
yeah.
or so. Scott Walker's how old right now?
Well, 70? In 1959, he's a teenager.
So, but right, I'm saying right now, he's 70.
Oh, he's 71.
71. So he starts making music as a teenager.
As a teenager, yeah.
How weird was it?
I think he started, you know, he was a charismatic kid with blonde hair and a big voice, you know. And for a while, he was being Svengali'd by Eddie Fisher. You know, and I think maybe he could have seen a career ahead of him as a theater singer. And then what happened to him was he was being sort of groomed to be like a Ricky Nelson type of kind of light rockabilly, a kind of a sub Elvis that really could be appreciated by parents.
Now, you went and spoke to Scott Walker. I don't know how much of his backstory was part of that conversation, but is your sense that at that time, at that age, that he was someone who was ready for that life, or he was already something of a dissenter?
It's really hard to know because mm-hmm. he just doesn't talk about the past.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really hard to get him to talk about the past. He's a really gracious guy, but he wants to talk about what he's doing now. And it's not out of rudeness. It's just, I mean, I know people like this, and they tend to be around his age or older, and they tend to work in more quiet and self-reflective art forms, you know? They get to a point where they've just been through enough trying to get their work understood by people that they just don't want to waste any more time.
A sidebar question, which is something that was on my mind reading your piece and listening to the album, which is, does Scott Walker have a day job?
No. Scott Walker, as far as I know, does not have a day job, unless you count scoring films and making music for dance companies, which he's done He's done some of that over the last 10, 20 years.
But his primary income for the last 2-3 decades, best we can tell, is...
Royalties? Could be. Don't know.
Album advances? These don't seem like musical choices designed for mortgage payments.
Right. Scott Walker has not played a live gig since 1978.
Mm-hmm.
He's only made 5, 6, I forget, something like that, records since then. And each one is rather expensive to make, you know? And they don't sell a lot. I mean, you know, they get lots of 5-star reviews. But you know, he was in a famous band. What kind of deal he got with that band, with Royal, who knows? I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But he was in a band that was said to be in their high season, 65 and 66, for about a year and a half. The subject of more insane girl frenzy than anyone except the Rolling Stones.
Let's go back.
Let's
Before
go back
that,
to,
let's start.
To the pre-England period.
Sure.
Scott Walker, then known as Scott Engel,
mm-hmm.
California teenager, making sort of rockabilly-esque records.
So we're going to hear Coming Home.
Coming Home.
From 1959.
We said goodbye. I saw you cry. But now I'm waiting for you. Let's don't turn back the time and hurt this heart of mine. I just can't stand it if we do. Well, it's gonna be better when I get your letter. Never, never cry, cause I won't say goodbye. This is gonna be the last letter, cause I know I'm coming home.
I feel like I want to use my best Casey Kasem voice.
Yeah.
That was Coming Home.
Well, see, this is
keep
the, this
reaching
is,
for the
this
stars.
This is what's really interesting about Scott Walker.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why he's kind of a fascinating person, is that he really, you know, in his early years, he went through the experience of being part of pop as pure commodity, real factory stuff, playing with orchestras and arrangements and, you know, lots of older session musicians, you know, on the Union clock and bang it out 4 tracks each session each day, you know, no messing around. And I think it, in a funny way, it hardened him and it taught him a lot about what can be done within the realm of pop. So he went from being a absolutely going through the meat grinder of pop culture, being a sort of, you know, Ricky Nelson-ish singer, to coming out the other end many, many years later as, you know, the artist beyond all artists.
Do you think that did he or does he fancy himself something of a created character? Because as you point out in your piece, Walker's not his given name.
Yeah.
And the music he's making now is nothing like the music he made in the Walker Brothers era.
Yeah.
And yet he's held on to that name. Is there something of a remove between him and what he's presenting on the record that he's using the name as sort of a defense for?
I think so, yes. And I don't really know much about his early life, but, you know, only child, who knows what. But, you know, I did ask him, why here? Why have you stayed in England so long? Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason that he went there is because he had this group called the Walker Brothers, and they wanted to be famous. There was an opportunity working with a producer in London. The ground was totally fertile for them to, like, you know, the iron was hot. They went over there. Within months, they were really famous. And he stayed. He never went back to America. But I asked him, you know, is there something about England that has informed your music or become part of you or whatever?
The fog.
The fog. Well, that's what I was thinking. The wet, you know,
yeah.
Something. The. And he was like, well, no, you know, I feel like I have more in common with Germany, really. But he was,
so he's a comedian too.
But he was saying, it doesn't really matter. I sort of float. I'm kind of apart from everything.
He's actually been moving back to the States for the last 40 years. It's just taking a long time.
Right.
It's an extremely slow move. Yeah, it seems noteworthy to me, given the radical change in his music. It seems noteworthy to me that he continues this sort of Walker character.
Yeah.
And I wonder, that's sort of why I was asking if he had a day job, because I was like, is he Scott Engel, substitute third grade teacher,
right,
you know, on Tuesdays and Thursdays?
Right.
And then, like, he sort of puts on his cape and cloak and retreats into the character and makes these records.
No, he's somewhat respected in England and, you know, has worked with the same people mostly since the 80s mm-hmm. and records for 4 AD, who really believes in him. And he's in the clear in mm-hmm. a way. He can make the kind of records that he wants to make.
Do you feel like at the height of the Walker Brothers fame, those were the kind of records he wanted to make at that time?
No, I get the sense that the artistic, the quality control in the Walker Brothers was extremely inconsistent, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, they were doing songs by other people, you know. There seemed to be a lot of stuff out of their control. And also, you know, I'm not sure about the chemistry between him and the other guys in the Walker Brothers. None of them were named Walker, and mm-hmm. they weren't brothers. It might not have been a perfect match.
So what is the peak Walker Brothers moment? Well, chemistry or not, what is the thing that, in a sense, he's probably spent 30 or 40 years railing and rejecting.
Right, exactly.
Railing against and rejecting.
If you were to turn it into a psychological, you know,
sure.
story, which is tempting.
That's why we get paid the big bucks.
The peak of the Walker Brothers is a hit called Make It Easy on Yourself, which was a big hit in England and over here. You know, it was this kind of like very gloomy, you know, Titanic wall of sound ballad. And his voice was in place. The croon was in place.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Mm-hmm.
Make It Easy on Yourself by the Walker Brothers.
Don't try to spare my feelings. Just tell me that we're through. And make it easy on yourself.
A thing you do hear on that song is sort of the intensity of his voice.
Yeah, I think that he is into the voice as a character in a drama. It's just not a drama necessarily about himself and his own life. That's the thing, you know, like an artiste he may be, but he's not the sort of singer, songwriter, confessional person at all. It's very hard to know what his songs are about, and he doesn't really want you to know. It's all quite removed. It's almost to the point now where his voice is just like an instrument
mm-hmm.
in the overall composition, and he's become sort of a composer. And just to get back one more time to the idea of like the difference between who he was at 17 or 20 and who he is now. It's so vast. You know, it's one of those things that you don't see very often in popular music. Like Miles Davis had that kind of thing where, you know, the difference between who Miles Davis was in 1955 and 71, say, that where the music is totally different. You struggle to make the connection. You struggle to understand how it could be the same person. And you see that obviously with like Picasso and James Joyce.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't see it in pop music all that much.
Is that partially, though, because he chose to continue making music? A very simple choice that a lot of people who are in prefab pop groups, etc., when they're young, when they burn out of that phase, they burn out of music altogether. It doesn't mean they don't have a muse, but they're not going into the studio. They're not releasing records. People don't believe in them to put out their records.
I think you're making a good point. I mean, the pure pop studio process that he went through as a young man, that can kill a guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it is interesting that he, you know, I mean, he sort of retreated from public view for a while and came back. But it is interesting that he came back convinced that he had something else to say, whereas most people would have just had enough.
Although I wonder sometimes if, say, for example, Scott Walker, Scott Engel, is 13, 14, 15 years old and says, hey, kid, you seem like you're into music. Come be in this band. And you say, I am kind of into music. I will be in this band, but I don't really know what I'm into. But sure, I want to play rock and roll and get girls for a living. Why not?
Right.
But that thing that predates your entry and your entree into pop music still resides within you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying Chris Kirkpatrick from NSYNC is going to suddenly make a drone record,
right.
But it does seem not out of the question that there are other people in other similar setups who are inclined towards music, maybe inclined towards unusual music, found themselves in these kinds of fabrication setups, and then maybe when they're free, assuming they haven't had the life beaten out of them, could make records like this.
They could, but you also have to find the right people to work. You have to be allowed to make records like this. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to find the right people to work with. You have to find people who will give you the green light, you know, and they have to be the right people. Maybe there's a whole element of luck in Scott Walker's story, at least in the first half of it,
mm-hmm.
that we're giving too little time to, you know? I don't know.
Or the luck is at the transition point where he reemerges in the 80s and says, I want to make these sorts of records. And yeah. someone steps up and says, I'll work with you. And another person steps up and says, I'll put it out.
Yeah.
We don't care that you had this past. It's a novel, but it's not sort of, we'll work with you in spite of these things.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
seems like a possibility.
Whatever it was that happened when he was getting... The Walker Brothers came to an end and he started making solo records.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that within him was this, you know, even before he left California as a teenager, he was into like European art house movies, you know, and maybe that was his sort of like dirty secret or
mm-hmm.
something
mm-hmm.
like, you know, I'm doing this bubblegum pop, but you know, what I'm really into is, you know,
sure.
Pasolini.
Mm-hmm.
So, so I think that during the time of the Walker Brothers, he gradually came into a character of like the dark, brooding existentialist, you know, talking about Camus in interviews and stuff. And I think he just sort of kept pushing that and saying, well, let's see where I can go with this.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time he was making his own solo records in the late 60s, he had this idea that he, I think, of making a sort of Walker Brother-esque light pop, very sort of relaxing baritone voice, romantic songs, but with totally dissonant string sections over it.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of crazy, but brilliant.
And he was making those records in Europe or he was making them in America?
He was making them in England, but
mm-hmm.
you know, for a major record company.
Mm-hmm.
And he found a string arranger who was willing to create these backdrops. And for me, the masterpiece of this idea of like discordance over comfort is this song called It's Raining Today.
Is it? It is, actually. So let's go.
It's raining today, and I'm just about to forget the train window girl that wonderful day we met. She smiles through the smoke.
Talk to me about It's Raining Today. Talk to me not just about the strings, but also we talked a little bit before about Scott Walker's vocal identity. And he does seem in these post-Walker Brothers records to really just sort of say, I'm out here. This is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
This is how I want to bend my voice. This is how I want to use it.
Yeah.
At that time, was anybody else doing stuff like that in this kind of context, or was it novel at the time?
Well, there was an English singer named Matt Monro who had this like big, croony, plummy voice, and he was not a risque pop singer. He was, you know, he was the kind of person that probably a lot of older people liked, you know what I mean?
Grandmoms.
Yeah, there was that. Did he love Matt Monro? I don't really know. He certainly had a fondness for, you know, Frank Sinatra and that kind of singer. But what he's doing
True croon.
Yeah. He did a whole... There's something chameleonic about him, too, because some of his early songs have an almost Roy Orbison sound,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and some of them are more sort of like disaffected and sexy, and he's sort of playing down his voice. But then when he, you know, starts to change, gets into his 30s and his 40s, he finds this other voice that's like higher and kind of a little more disturbing to listen to. He's worked through the baritone, and now he's like, he's in the baritone, but he's pushing up against the high part of the baritone. Strange,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that he started to develop an interest in making the listener feel really strange.
Not a foreign instinct in pop music. Not the first person to be working with these forums to do that. But how did people find him when he started putting out these records in the 80s that sort of marked the beginning of this phase of his career? How did people find him? Because it's not like it is today where you throw up a record on the internet and a bunch of weirdos get on it and then all of a sudden it's best new music on Pitchfork. It wasn't like that. So I assume he was building an audience from scratch.
Right. Well, he was, you know, he was a boy band star, and then he was an ex-boy band weirdo, and then he was nowhere, just in the wilderness. And he made a sort of comeback doing kind of country pop records, singing songs by Bobby Bear and people like that. And they were total failures, and he disavows that part of his work.
Well, the one you did email me one of those songs, and I just want to go on record saying I enjoyed that record.
Some of them are good, but as albums, they don't work.
They don't sing.
They're all over the place, you know. At some point, 80s, I think, a guy named Julian Cope, who was in this group, The Teardrop Explodes, and he's done these books about Japanese rock and whatever, kind of archivist, you know, and celebrator of weirdness in music. He put together an anthology called The Godlike Genius of Scott Walker. And that was the moment when a lot of people rediscovered him and framed him in the right way.
Sure.
Maybe it comes down, you know, the second half of his career, the excitement around him comes down to that.
Some hipster. Some hipster.
Yeah.
That's cool. So
that's the way it happens.
It is the way it happens, even then, even in the 80s. So Soused is the sixth album of this period, sixth or seventh. Let's talk about why he chose to work with who he chose to work with on this album.
Well, the thing to remember is that Scott Walker was a bass player originally. Mm. You know, in the early days of the Walker Brothers, that was his instrument. And he's really, as he told me, he's really interested in finding like primal sounds, you know. I mean, again, not to like psychologize this, but the guy's interested in pain, you know, and like some sort of direct howl from the inner soul. Mm-hmm. So primal sounds, he's interested in sounds that are like not totally recognizable, impressive, but you don't quite know what produced them or where they came from. He got in his head the idea of working with drones. Sun actually approached him to sing on a record they did in 2009, but he couldn't do it.
I did think that was a funny point in your piece, and he was unavailable, but I just couldn't fathom what he was doing.
Why he was unavailable?
Like what was going on?
Well, he was probably working on his own record.
Sure.
I mean, his records take a long time to make in one way or another, either because he's working so hard on the lyrics, which could just mean, you know, it takes like 7 or 8 days of dreams to come up with, you know, one stanza.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Or it's just it's hard to get together all the 40 strings for each of these records, except for the new one. In any case, they love him. He heard their records because they sent him their records. He realized that he really liked them, and he realized, this is who I want as my backing band. They made it work really effectively. I think Scott Walker at this point has so much experience working in studios, and he's got a producer he always works with, and an orchestrator and arranger he always works with. Those people sort of like come with the package deal of Scott Walker. And Sun is also really drilled in how to make records, how to represent their sound.
Sure.
Because their sound is like, it's simple, and yet it's very complicated.
And super specific.
Super specific. Mm-hmm. And they've got, you know, they had so many amps in the room that they almost had to, you know, break out a wall.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the loudest thing in the world, and they had to figure out how to record it. But they knew how to do it.
An interesting thing you point out in your piece is that, in effect, Scott Walker composed a thing that then Sun performed, which is maybe not what the guys in Sun normally would do.
Not at all. And also, the guys in Sun, they produce themselves. Mm-hmm. Stephen O'Malley from Sun produces everything that they do. So they had to yield that control. Not only that, they had to yield the control of, you know, writing their own music. So Scott Walker had a very good idea of what Sun should play and what they could play. And he sent it to them as a demo, and they said, this is it. This is what we do. Now, that's interesting because there's a track on the reunited Walker Brothers made a record in 1978 called Night Flights. And four of the songs, I think, are by Scott Walker and basically just Scott Walker.
Solo songs.
Yeah, more or less. And there's this song called The Electrician that begins with... I know it's such a Scott Walker title.
It's great.
It's a song called "The Electrician" that's and you hear it and it's like, bong, and you know it's 1978, but basically that's Sun.
Yeah,
I don't think there's a mistake here. You know, I mean, these guys love Scott Walker. It all sort of connects backwards and forwards.
Tell me about why this album feels. Approachable feels like the wrong word, but it is sort of a distillation of the idea you're talking about.
You heard it, right?
Yeah.
Is approachable the word you would use?
No, but look at what we're comparing it to, perhaps by comparison.
What I'm saying is that Scott Walker, the jarring thing about listening to a Scott Walker record, like, for example, let's choose a Scott Walker record that is really accomplished and really super fine, and yet it's hard to listen to, in my view, is The Drift. There's a lot going on in these songs, and he's always sort of throwing you off the scent. You know, he's always redirecting you, making abrupt changes, disturbing you in one way or another. If you're into that, that's great, but I find it a kind of discontinuous experience listening to these records. Whereas with a lot of Soust, there's the drone as a continuity underneath it, and it's a beautiful sound. It's really rich. I find that, you know, I can listen to Scott Walker do all kinds of strange things on top of that, and it seems to cohere. I can listen to this record and have done a lot. There's one other thing. In a lot of the interviews with Scott Walker, there's a passage of the interview where the interviewer always points to some part of a record and says that part is really scary or disturbing or weird. And Scott Walker says, "Oh, but you have to understand. You have to listen for the humor in my records because I intend for them to be funny. I want them to be funny, you know? So I even confessed this to him, like, I don't really hear the humor a lot, you know? But there is that thing that we came in on at the beginning of the show, the opening seconds of Brando, I think is hilarious when you've got the two opposing guitars and the first one is mighty and strong and broad and clean, and then the second one sort of like assaults it, you know, and it's about 20 decibels louder. I think that's hilarious.
So sort of like a Kinnison thing or more of a Seinfeld thing?
Yes, it's the second one is Kinnison and the first one is, you know, Bill Cosby. I don't know.
No one tell Bill Cosby that.
Anyway, the first one is comforting. The second one is totally disruptive, you know. Like some oaf who steps into a movie shoot and gets right in front of the camera, you know? I think that's just a great moment.
Let's close out with, I was going to say Scott Walker's tears, but actually it's probably more Scott Walker's guffaws with Herod 2014.
The deer fly, the sand fly, the tsetse can't find them. The gold from the star sea is left far behind them. Their delicate dharma won't witness a ray.
Wipe the blood out your ears. This has been the New York Times podcast talking about Scott Walker. My guest has been Ben Ratliff. Thank you very much. You can read Ben writing about Scott Walker and all forms of drone foolery at nytimes.com/music. Check out our Spotify playlist. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our producers are Jeremy Egner and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and get back with us next week.